Welcome to Career Buzz, Canada's unique radio conversation that empowers lives, enriches careers, and energizes organizations. Today on your show, the power of social networks and the value of social capital for career success. Hi, I'm Mark Franklin, practice leader of Career Cycles, a career management social enterprise. I'm pleased to be your host today on Career Buzz. Thanks for tuning in this morning. And a special welcome to members of the Association of Career Professionals International tuning in on the internet from across the globe. John Paul Hatala joins Career Buzz this morning to share his research and development on social networking to empower job search and also on social capital for career development. Dr. Hatala is currently an assistant professor at Rochester Institute of Technology, a senior fellow at the University of Ottawa, and an adjunct professor at Louisiana State University. He's founder of a social capital development firm, Flowwork International. John Paul is presently a regular blogger on Contact Point and has been featured in the Globe and Mail, CBC Radio, and other media outlets. His latest book is called The Strategic Networker, A Learner's Guide to Effective Networking. Intercultural economist Linda Manning experienced being an immigrant herself, coming to Canada from the United States. Dr. Manning's work focuses now on the success of immigrants in the workplace. Linda is a senior fellow at the University of Ottawa and founder of Leadership Mosaic. Her academic research focuses on inclusive talent management. Linda Manning joins us live by telephone from Ottawa. Welcome, Linda.
Thank you. Hi.
Hi there. And John Paul Hatala joins us live by phone from Rochester, New York. Welcome, John Paul.
Thank you, Mark.
Thanks to both of you for joining us to share your passion and insights for career and workplace success. And I'd also like to invite listeners on this show to get involved in the radio conversation we're having here. As you're listening, please email your questions to mark@careercycles.com or post to Twitter @careercycles. Linda, what do you like about your career these days?
Well, what I like really is that I'm doing something that I'm passionate about. I think that I actually have an opportunity to make an impact on businesses and how they integrate immigrants into their workplaces.
Now, you call yourself an intercultural economist. What is that, and what does one do?
Well, it's what one does as an intercultural economist is what I do, because I sort of made up that that title to describe what I do. I think that I come from an economics background. I've been an economics professor for a number of years, and so I apply my economics approach to everything that I do. So I find that every time I talk to an employer about how they need to tap into the skills, hidden talents of their immigrant employees, that I'm using an economic model.
Now, we've talked on Career Buzz to many guests, and one of the questions I like to start with in terms of understanding where people are coming from and the use of their own strengths in their work. What would you say are your key strengths that you draw on to be an effective intercultural economist?
I guess, first of all, my background as a world traveler, if you will, because I was a military brat as a child, so I lived in various countries, not just traveled to different countries. I have taken my path from being a kid who didn't have any expectation to go to university to transforming into a PhD. So I remember when I was in high school, I was really good in math, but I was a girl. So my guidance counselor told me that I really would make a good secretary because I was good in math, and so I should take typing. And the courses that I started taking to develop my business acumen to be a secretary actually led me to take courses in university for business, which then led to my first economics course. And when I took that course, I was sold. I knew that's what I wanted to do.
Amazing story. And there's so many stories with crazy twists and turns like that, and advice of well-meaning people who give really unhelpful advice that ultimately turns out to be effective in a kind of backwards way.
If you make use of it, that's right.
That's right. Mm-hmm. John Paul Hatala, what about you? What do you like about your career these days?
I guess the biggest thing I like is freedom to kind of explore things, and I think that's what academia provides someone, is the opportunity to pose questions and then look for answers to those questions. And I think that's an exciting undertaking. It's always changing. It doesn't always result in what you hope it to be, but I think the journey is part of the excitement.
Now, I mentioned on the interview on the intro that you're doing a number of things. You're working well at a couple of universities, and also you have a company called Flowwork. So, what are all the things that keep you busy these days?
Yeah, well, probably my main thing is being a professor and working with students in a human resource development program, which focuses on the individual aspects of employees and organizations and how they can perform effectively to meet organizational outcomes and so forth, and that's really taking up a lot of my time. And within that, my research area focuses on the notion of social capital within the workplace, social networking behaviors, and outside of that, it looks at the transition towards the labor market and how individuals make that transition. And so that's a big part of it. And what's neat about academia, at least in my experience, is the notion of bringing theory to practice. And that's where Flowwork International comes into play, is taking not only my own research, but research that exists out there and dwindling it down to a level where it can actually be applied and help people in what they're trying to do.
Great. I want to look more at that later in the interview and all those things that you are doing in putting theory to practice. Let me come back to the question of strengths for you, JP. What are the strengths that you use regularly in your work?
Yeah, I think probably, if I were to examine that closely, I would say my ability probably to break things down and to simplify it as much as possible, although it's not always possible, but in order to break it down and simplify it and examine what's actually going on within a specific situation, specific area, and so forth. And I think that's a really important element of what I do, is taking this complex, kind of scenario and identifying what's working, what's not working, and looking at ways to improve or to enhance or to maintain.
Right on, thanks. So a kind of analysis skill, breaking things down and simplifying.
Correct, yeah.
Right on. My guests today are Dr. Linda Manning and Dr. Jean-Paul Hatala, researchers and professionals in the area of social networking and social capital. And I'd also like to invite listeners to get involved in today's radio conversation. While you're listening, please email your questions to Mark, that's Mark with a K, at careercycles.com, or post to Twitter, at careercycles. And I'd like to get to your areas of research in a moment, but I'd like to get a bit more of your career stories that brought you to the present moment. Linda, at the beginning, you took us back a little bit to tell us what led you away from the secretarial path and towards a more academic background. What ultimately led you to the area of study that you focused on in your doctorate?
Oh, my area of study, my doctor was economics. As I said, I took my very first economics course. And when that happened, I realized that it gave me a structure to analyze how I was making choices and how to make good decisions. And so I was absorbed in it and was passionate about it.
Unlike some professors, I understand you became intensely interested in the learning process itself. How did that interest develop, and what became of it?
Well, it was interesting because I went through school and got the PhD without any real understanding what I would be doing with that when I finished, except that there are a number of things that an economist can do. And I got my first teaching position, and as seems to happen in my life, when I find myself doing something, I realize I really like this. So I really found that I loved teaching, and it was stunning because, of course, in academia, you don't get much credit for teaching. That's not really number one on most people's list of things to do. So I started doing research on teaching and learning and pedagogy just to allow myself the time to spend on teaching. So I became a sort of a resident expert on teaching and learning. And I happened to be on a campus where there were a lot of engineering students. About 75% of the programs were engineering. And I learned that as an economist, my behaviors and expectations as an economist ruled by that genre of study was different than it was for the engineers. So I learned that I had to adapt my teaching style to their learning style. And that led to another area of research for me to find out more about that. And so I sort of became a little resident expert on integrating technology into teaching and learning to adapt to different students' learning styles.
Can you give us an example for all the engineers listening? And it turns out my first career is in engineering. So what's an example of having to adapt the teaching style to these engineers in the campus that you're working at?
Well, I think the thing that stands out in my memory the most was that I am process-oriented. I'm systems-oriented, process-oriented. And the engineering students that I was teaching were much more directive, and they would say to me, look, could you just give us an equation? We'll give you an answer, okay? They wanted to be able to do tasks that completed, you know, that they could find a solution for. They didn't really want to do things like, well, let's define the problem first. Let's decide which of the tools that we have available to us to solve that problem might be best, and let's do an analysis. And they used to joke with me. I would say, no, that's not what I want you to do, and they would all in unison say, yes, we know, it's a process. And so it was a very interesting dichotomy, and I realized that I couldn't fight that. What I needed to do was understand that that's what they'd been rewarded to do, that's what they'd been socialized to do, that's what they were comfortable with. So I needed to make sure that what I taught, how I wrote exams, how I assessed them, had to include components that allowed them to do what they did best if I expected them to do anything related to process.
Nice, good. Thanks for that example.
Yeah.
So that ultimately led you to get more involved in the whole process of teaching and actually teaching teachers or teaching professors on how to be more effective.
Right. So, yes, I've actually been all over the world doing that. It's really quite funny.
Now, something led you ultimately to leave the United States, where you were working, and come to Canada. What was the trigger there?
Well, the trigger was my husband, who had accepted a position in Canada. And so I had tenure back in the States, so I took a sabbatical and spent a year here. And again, as happens with me, I fell in love with Ottawa. So I decided to stay, and we decided to stay in Canada. And I resigned my position in the U.S.
Now, I know we'll talk a little bit about your work with newcomers and immigrants, but what was your own experience like adapting to your new country when you arrived and started to acculturate to Canada and to the city of Ottawa?
You know, it's always been fascinating to me because one wouldn't think that an American would run into cultural differences in Canada because, of course, everybody assumes we're so alike. And maybe a lot of the differences aren't as obvious. They're sometimes quite subtle, but they're very, very powerful. And so even I would run into these little things, especially like at the university. Different expectations were creating conflicts. And I was realizing that sometimes I couldn't get things done because of those conflicts.
So can you give a couple of examples that listeners might connect to that are kind of typically Canadian things, but maybe something that an American would see differently?
Well, it could be, for instance, one of the things that I've learned is when I write emails, Americans tend to be extremely direct. Now, Canadians do think of themselves as direct in their communication, and they are more direct than many other cultures might be, but not as direct as somebody like I, apparently. Because when I would write emails to request something, I would find that I would either not get a response or get a response saying they would do whatever I asked, and then they wouldn't do it. And I learned eventually that I had to establish a relationship with them first. Sometimes I had to go visit them at their office, or at least when I wrote the email, what I started to do is I'd write my very directive, here's my request, when can you get it to me? And I would sandwich it with introductory social kind of interaction and then end it with social interaction to kind of soften my tendency to be so direct. And then I found that I got better results.
Well, that's really interesting. Thanks for sharing that. We actually had a guest on Career Buzz a while ago, Will Schwab, who wrote a book about email and how it can either help or hurt your career and the career-limiting mistakes that people make by email. I'd love to hear listeners' perspective on what was just said there. If you have a comment or question, especially on this question of a simple thing like email and how it can be very different, and different cultures do email differently. So if you have a comment or question on that, let us know. It's mark@careercycles.com or on Twitter, post to @CareerCycles. John Paul, what about you? Your story, what led you back to academia to pursue your doctorate?
I guess, you know, growing up in Canada, like most young boys, my goal was playing hockey, and I thought early on that would be my career, and like everyone thought probably at the time to play in the NHL, and unfortunately, like so many others, that didn't come to be. And I was quite fortunate early on to realize that I wanted to be a teacher, and I wanted to teach, and that was thanks in part to being a hockey instructor in my teenage years. And so I decided at that point that if I wanted to be a teacher, I'd need to probably get a graduate degree, so a master's program. And I didn't want to teach in elementary or secondary school. I wanted to teach at the college, university level. For some reason, that just had a greater appeal to me. And so I went and did my master's, graduated from my master's, and was confident I would get a job. At least my parents told me that as long as you get, you get your education, you have a great chance of getting a job. And I must have sent out about 200 resumes or curriculum vitaes, and didn't get a response. I think I got one letter saying thank you for sending in your resume, and I realized right then and there that my parents lied to me, and that
that never happens, does it?
Yeah, exactly. I realized for the first time. Go figure. And so I knew that I wasn't going to be a professor right then and there. There was other factors than, you know, just a master's degree. It involved experience, which I didn't have. I was still wet behind the ears, just coming out of a master's program, had never really worked before. And so I realized that in order to become a professor, and I still wanted to do, one, I would probably have to obtain my PhD, but two, I would have to gain some experience. And I think this kind of foreshadowed my research interest, in that I realized that every opportunity I took along the way, I would somehow have to link it to becoming a professor, or at the very least make me more competitive when I applied for a professor's position. And my focus was in human resource development. And so, every job, I remember the first job I took was as an employment counselor at a nonprofit agency. And I linked it to a professor in the fact that, you know, I'd have to facilitate a workshop, or I'd have to design some curriculum and so forth. So, you know, I took the opportunity. Even though the pay wasn't there, it wasn't a priority, it was the fact that I could acquire these skills, or these competencies, if you will, that would eventually make me more competitive once, I had the opportunity to apply. And so, it progressed from that position to other positions, again, linking it to my main goal of a professor, and then decided to go back to do my PhD, which was a course required, and did that while I was working. And I remember over the period of time at taking a job, an opportunity in Louisiana came up to teach in the Human Resource Development Program, and I applied to it. And I'll still never forget the question that was asked to me in the interview from the panel. They asked me, why do you think you're the best fit for this position? And I told them, well, let me tell you a story. It all starts back when I was a young boy hockey player, made the decision to become a professor, went to do my master's program, applied for a lot of jobs, didn't get it. So every job I took, reinforced the fact that I'd be a competitive candidate for this position. And fortunately, I got the job.
That's a great story. And what's interesting about it is maybe the perspective, JP, that you used, which was looking at the dream job, never losing sight of the dream job, aiming high, but recognizing that there are some stepping stones along the way, but utilizing those stepping stones with a very strong kind of contextual focus for what you wanted. That sounds like a winning formula.
Yeah, and obviously it worked for me. It was probably a 13-year process, and probably it's due to the fact that, like I said, I was wet behind the ears. I didn't have any experience, and it took some time to do that. And plus just the nature of academia, how competitive it is. So, you know, it was a staged process. I never lost sight of what I ultimately wanted to do. Somehow I was able to remain motivated, and that was probably, you know, seeing or having a passion for teaching, for conducting research and so forth. So, yeah, definitely it was a staged process, and I was committed to the process and the ultimate goal, which was my dream job.
You know, people might have just reacted a moment ago when you said it was a 13-year process. I felt myself reacting there. And as listeners are hearing that story, and, you know, people might say, gee, I mean, how did he have the patience to go through that? And I wonder if you have some advice for listeners, if especially for people who aim high and they put in front of themselves something really amazing that they want, and it's a job at the top end of their field or a leadership position, and they're nowhere near it at the beginning. What advice do you have for sticking with it, or for putting that focus firmly in your head and your mind and your heart, so that you can stick through the ups and downs of a lengthy process?
Yeah, and that's a good question. It's a good thing to really kind of sit back and dissect, because, you know, when I first moved to Louisiana, I heard the saying, "How do you eat an elephant?" Of course, the answer is to that one piece at a time. And ultimately, becoming a professor was my elephant. And it's, imagine sitting down at the table and trying to eat this big, you know, piece of elephant. And it's overwhelming. And so really what I did was I broke it down into smaller goals. And these goals in and of themselves, I made sure that they were attainable, one, so were they realistic? And two, could I experience some sort of success right away? And I think that combination of those two things, when I did achieve it, you know, motivated me to move on to the next goal or next step or next bite, if you will. And really, it sustained my motivation throughout, because if I just would have thought of it from the perspective of, you know, I want to be a professor and it's going to take 13 years, I would have quit.
Yes.
I compare it to going on a diet. I remember once I was going to try to lose 25 pounds, and I focused on the 25 pounds, and I quit after the first week when I actually gained weight, because it was just too far out. And I think we're not built for, you know, long-term satisfaction. We need short-term satisfaction or propel us to the next step.
Yes.
And along that 13 years, you know, it wasn't a 13-year plan. It was, you know, 6 months, 6 months, 6 months, 6 months.
So it's more the intention. The intention stays there, but it's the smaller pieces, as you say, and experiencing success on those smaller pieces on a consistent basis.
Correct.
Yeah, great advice. Thanks for sharing that story, JP. And last question for you about the story, and we had just checked with Linda, who had the experience of moving from Canada to the U.S. What's your experience on the other way? You commute between Ontario and Rochester, New York. What do you notice about the cultural shifts between at least your corners of the two nations?
Yeah, I have to say, I probably don't see much of a difference between the two cultures. They're quite similar in nature in the sense that, you know, the population in which I'm dealing with students, and ultimately they're striving for the same goal, which is to graduate, to get a job, et cetera, et cetera. So I haven't really seen much of a difference between the two, and maybe it's because of, you know, I'm not necessarily aware or looking for that, but I don't really see a difference between the two.
Interesting. Well, we're going to aim back at that conversation in a few minutes. My guests today are Dr. Linda Manning and Dr. John Paul Atala, researchers and professionals in the areas of social networking and social capital. I'm your host, Mark Franklin, here on Career Buzz CIUT 89.5 FM in Toronto and CIUT.FM worldwide. And I'd also like to invite listeners to get involved in our conversation today with email. You can email your questions or comments to Mark with a K at careercycles.com or post to Twitter at careercycles. JP, let's have a little focus on your work now and go back and forth, Linda Manning, with you as well. First, I'd like you to give us an overview of what you mean by the term social capital.
Okay. The simple definition is essentially the relationships that we have in our lives and the social resources embedded within those relationships. And a social resource could be defined as, you know, as an individual who has contact, experience, knowledge, etc. And so, you know, the neat thing about social capital is that everybody has it, regardless of who they are. You could be the biggest jerk in the world and still have a certain level of social capital. And obviously, the more relationships we have, the greater access we have to social resources, and therefore, if we're able to leverage those, our objectives could be accomplished much easier. So it's kind of looking at social capital as a way of accomplishing our objectives or goals in life. And I know that sounds transactional, but it's very important to keep that in mind, to keep in mind that as long as we're willing to give back to our network as much as we're willing to take, we should be okay. Things will balance out. So that means not only do we have to be clear on what we want to accomplish and what social resources we think will help us accomplish that, we have to know what sort of things we offer the network in return. So, for example, if we put it in the context of looking for work, there are the more social capital we have, the greater access we have to the hidden job market, because people are going to be connected to other individuals who may know of opportunities, job-related information, et cetera, et cetera. So social capital, you know, regardless of whether the outcome you're trying to obtain through an objective, is helpful in every way.
And you used the word network there a moment ago. So another word that people are commonly familiar with is network, and it sounds like there's a connection there, social capital, the network of connections that you have, and then using it for whatever goal you want to put in front of you, but often it's an employment-related goal, like accessing the hidden job market. Is that right?
Correct.
Yeah.
Absolutely.
And we're going to have to take a break in a moment. Linda, I just want to bring you into the conversation, and just as a high-level response to what you just heard JP say, because you too focus on social networks, but it's more about the cultural norms and social networks within organizations. Can you just start us off here? What's your perspective on the value of social capital within organizations?
Well, as JP was saying, The essence of these networks is that you can reach goals better, and the resources embedded in those networks are important to any of us to try to reach our goals. As an economist, let me say that what we talk about is, okay, I have this objective, I need to allocate my resources. That's a terminology we use. Allocate our resources and manage our costs. Now, the allocation of our resources has to include the resources we have available to us through our relationships. And we can tap into those and we can give to those. In the workplace, just consider anything when somebody is trying to get something done and they don't have all the resources embedded in themselves to get it done, so they have to call somebody. They have to send a memo or make a phone call or ask somebody. That's how things get done in the workplace. And the more access somebody has to building that network, the better. And it turns out that people who come into an organization from a different culture often don't have access to that network.
Right. So that's one of the key things I know that your research has been focusing on, is the
mm-hmm.
value
mm-hmm.
of those networks, and then how you can access them if you're starting off with a kind of deficit in that area.
And how the organization can foster that and facilitate that too.
Excellent. So those
it's
are
in
the
their
two
best interest.
Interesting threads. We're going to pick up these threads and talk a little bit more about social capital and social network for career success in a few minutes. We're going to take a little break for some music and station identification. You're listening to Career Buzz on CIUT. I'm your host, Mark Franklin. We're going to take a little musical break. Leslie Feist here with Past is Present.
Got it. CIUT 89.5 FM, broadcasting live 24 hours a day, 7 days a week. From Hart House, University of Toronto.
We're back at Career Buzz. I'm your host, Mark Franklin, here on CIUT 89.5 FM in Toronto and worldwide on CIUT.FM. Before moving on to our interview with JP Hatal and Linda Manning, I want to let listeners know the upcoming Enriching Lives and Careers trip to Nicaragua, a service learning experience, February 23rd to March 2nd. If you're interested, more information available, check careercycles.com and click on Enriching Travel for details. John-Paul Hatala, we've been talking to you a little bit about social capital and social capital development. To set the tone for this and to get into a bit more detail on it, first, what are the benefits of understanding and using social capital for all kinds of people?
Well, and I guess the benefits are ultimately, I think the first thing is the ability to give back to your network, as well as to leverage the social resources to accomplish an objective or a goal. And ultimately, I think that's the bottom line. It's this notion of reciprocity.
Yes.
And helping each other out, whether it be for financial, emotional, you know, employment, career support, whatever it may be. There's value in the collective efforts of everyone, and I think what happens a lot of the time is, especially if we're talking about specific populations, i.e. the unemployed, they tend to become more isolated for whatever reason. And when this does happen, they tend to think less of their social capital and how benefit them, get out of their situation in finding a job and so forth. So social capital is a powerful thing, and having access to certain types of social resources can help you accomplish your objective. I wanted to do some work on my house, and I didn't want to spend a lot of money on doing it. Rather than going directly to a contractor, I thought about individuals in my network who potentially have the skills and abilities, or at the very least know somebody with those skills and abilities to help me. And that was quite beneficial. And then there's other situations, I think, along my career path where, because I knew someone and I spoke to them about what I was doing at the particular time, I was able to find a job. And it's just being, consciously aware of that. And even in light of the fact that social networking is at the top of everybody's mind, thanks in part to technology, I'm not sure if we all think about it at the conscious level.
Yeah, you've written about that. In fact, I saw one of the things that you write about is bringing this process that we all do on some level, but bring it from what you call an unconscious activity to a conscious one. So can you just talk a bit about that? Like, people are talking all the time, they're connecting, they're asking people for referrals. Is it really unconscious, or what is it? Is it semi-conscious? And then what can we do to bring it to a much more conscious level?
Yeah, and I think it's becoming more aware of it. And I think, from a job search perspective, if I were to focus in on that, a lot of many individuals that I work with, you ask them what's their source for job leads, as an area.
Yes.
And they'll go on the job boards or look in the newspaper or traditional sources. And they don't naturally think about, well, who's in my network, who are they connected to, or who do they work for, and how could I leverage them in a positive way to find out about what opportunities exist out there.
Right. And, yeah, go ahead.
And I was just saying, I think it's really important. It sounds like a, you know, like a simple thing, but there's a switch in our head where we need to kind of flip on, saying that, you know, there's potential in our network. We just need to be aware of it and access it. And that should be the first go-to rather than, you know, these traditional sources.
You've got a formula that you talk about that kind of that creates an abbreviation for it. And there are three factors that I've seen in it that help you utilize social capital for some kind of outcome: knowledge, access, and utilization. So what do you mean by those three things that are part of this formula?
Yeah, and where that comes from is the biggest question is, what's going to motivate us to connect with others? And I think, you know, and this is not scientific in any nature, but just from some polls, polls and some surveys, you know, what we're finding is that, you know, 50-60% of us are not comfortable connecting with people other than we are directly connected to, so our second degrees and third degrees. So this goes against us. So the question becomes, what's going to motivate us to connect with individuals, to connect with our social capital? And the knowledge accessing utility, knowledge is really about what are your goals, what are your objectives, and not keeping them so broad like an elephant, but breaking them down into small bite-sized pieces and being clear on what you accomplish. And when setting the goals, not only setting them for yourself, but setting them for the network. And what I mean by that is being able to clearly articulate and explain to somebody what you're trying to accomplish.
Right, and that's a tall order right there. Like most people, in our experience, you know, we have a small career company that we speak to lots of people, and that seems to be a tricky thing for many people to do, is to articulate what it is that they actually want that's going to fit in with who they are. So, I mean, that's a stopper right there for some people. How do we get clear on that piece, that knowledge piece, as you've called it?
Yeah, absolutely, and the clearer you get, the more response you're going to get from your network. The less clear or more ambiguous it is, the less response you're going to get. And what's human nature to give up when we don't get any response?
Right. So, it seems like an example of that. If you're asking your network, sometimes you hear people say, well, I fired off my resume to my network and basically handing over the job search process to other people. And instead of saying, you know, hey Bernadette, I know you, and what I've really been looking for is something that's got working in a post-secondary institution, and I'm sending my resume, but could you connect me with somebody who you know for me to then make that connection, which is a much more proactive position that I think far fewer people do.
Correct. I would agree with that. And looking, when we're talking about requests from the network, is, you know, I've kind of classified them in low risk requests and high risk requests. And the type of request that you make is based on your strength of relationship. So, if, for example, if I have a weak relationship with somebody, I'm not going to have or ask for a high-risk request. I'm going to do a low-risk request. And a high-risk request may be asking for a job.
Yes.
A low-risk request may be saying, I'd love some information on the hiring trends in your industry, where they can simply fire it over and it has nothing to do with relationship because there's no real impact on that. So I think a lot of individuals make that mistake where they'll go to the network, whether it's face-to-face or online,
yes,
and throw out there saying, I'm looking for a job, can anybody help me, when they don't have a relationship to begin with in the first place.
Right. So you've categorized this as that high-risk kind of thing, and they don't have the strength of relationship to make that work, and it fails, then they get discouraged, and they say, forget it.
Correct. Exactly. Exactly, and that's what it is. And if we don't experience successes, we're less likely to move forward. So why set ourselves up for failure right from the get-go? Let's learn how to, you know, approach it strategically so that we can benefit quite well from it. And the problem with networking, if we're even looking at networking, it's a delayed reward, because most likely the information you're looking for doesn't come from that first point of contact. It comes from the connections of that first point, which takes time.
Yeah, so it's usually that second person or third in your network and not the person you actually know.
Correct.
Right. Yeah. I whenever we talk about this, I find so many people turned off by the term networking that we've used something called authentic communication. People seem to respond to that term. You know, I'm just going to have an authentic conversation and talk to my friend Bernadette here about my job search, as opposed to the networking thing that turns people off. Have you found that? And there's different reactions back to that motivation that you were talking about, or inspiring people to take that step. That there are certain use of language that turn people off, and ones that turn people on.
Yeah, no, absolutely. And language often gets in the way. Authentic communication or networking, you know, entails some of the same processes and some of the same tactics. It's just the way of phrasing it. And when something's overused like networking, you know, people are turned off to it. But individuals come up with me and saying, I'm nervous when I connect with people. I don't know what to do. The first thing, obviously, like I said, is knowledge of your goals and what you want to accomplish. That in of itself may motivate somebody. But also thinking about, you know, what do you have to bring to your network? When's the last time you went out and helped somebody?
Right on.
Forces them to have a conversation.
Right. Back to your term reciprocity that you used at the beginning. It's a give back. It's an exchange as opposed to a one-way thing.
Correct.
Great. We're talking to Dr. John Paul Hatala and Dr. Linda Manning here on Career Buzz. They're both researchers and professionals in the areas of social networking and social capital. I'd like to invite guests or listeners here to get involved. Give us a call or contact us by email or Twitter. It's mark@careercycles.com. Send us your comments or questions, and Twitter @careercycles. And let us know what you think or questions for Linda and JP. Linda Manning, let me come back to you now after we've been talking a little bit about the value and the use of social networks. Your angle is more in organizations. There was an important project that you got involved with that started this all off. Can you tell us a bit about that project?
Sure. I was very lucky. I got some funding from the Government of Canada to study the integration of immigrants into the Canadian workplace. When I first came to Canada, I realized that there was this huge disconnect going on that employers were facing skill shortages that we're still hearing about because of retiring baby boomers. And at the same time, we have skills entering Canada through immigrants, because we're letting in immigrants or bringing in immigrants who have much higher skills and credentials and education than the average Canadian does in many cases. But there seemed to be a big problem. One was they couldn't get jobs. But second, even when they got jobs, they tended to be underemployed, or there was high turnover. They weren't getting promoted. They weren't getting advanced, and it took them about 10 years to catch up in terms of income comparison to their Canadian counterparts. So I decided to look at what was going on in the workplace with managers and their relationships with employees, to find out maybe what the managers might be doing that might be unintentionally causing some of these problems, because of course, these employers still needed those skills and they were losing them. So we found two huge outcomes that resonate totally with JP, and that's why JP and I know each other and work together because of this. Two outcomes were that managers were having trouble recognizing and valuing the skills and abilities of their immigrant employees. We think because of cultural norms and expectations and unexamined assumptions that people make when they just look at somebody who's different than they are. And second, the lack of social capital, the access to social capital in the workplace. Those two things came up in focus groups with immigrants, with HR professionals, and with managers across two provinces in Canada, in both French and in English. That was consistent across the board. So one of the things that I want to mention about this social capital thing, a lot of people confuse the relationship building that we're talking about with utility relationships. We're not talking about building relationships to serve us. It's about tapping into the networks that we've had, and then we've developed these relationships over time. And I can tie the social capital together with this recognition of talent, because as JP said, in the workplace, one of the primary things about this social capital concept is reciprocity. It means you have to be able to give back.
Yes.
If employees, their skills and abilities are not being recognized, they're not even you know, people don't even see them as having those skills and abilities. No one's ever going to call on them for those skills and abilities, so they're not going to get an opportunity to give back. So it breaks that cycle of social capital, and they, as JP says, become more isolated. They have decreased chances of getting promoted or even being granted training that they need for further development, and so they don't survive or don't succeed as much as they would in the workplace.
So let's now look at the flip side of that, and it's a familiar problem, especially, you know, those of us in the very multicultural big cities across Canada. It's just a real mosaic of people, and there's a lot of different things going on inside organizations, but yet we're always clued in, we're aware of the lack of opportunities that many newcomers have. So in contrast, you've got this term you use called inclusive talent management within organizations. So what does that mean, and maybe if you can give an example to help us out.
Well, basically what it means to me is, well, in HR there's this term called talent management, as JP can attest to. It's basically the management of a person's abilities and competencies and credentials throughout their lifespan and with the employer, trying to make sure that they're tapping into those to best serve the employer's needs, which, of course, is productivity and profit and so forth. And inclusive talent management means, let's take a look at the way that we do things that used to work to motivate people, to engage employees, to make sure that they're productive, and check to see if maybe they don't work so well anymore because we're dealing with a different group of people who come with a different set of cultural norms and behaviors.
So with that as a backdrop, what can organizations actually do to shift gears here and to have a more inclusive talent management set of policies and procedures?
I think that my model is very similar to JP's, actually. First, I think there needs to be some awareness building and understanding that it's not that they are different than us. It is that we are all different and that we come with our own set of cultural norms and behaviors, expectations that we have, and it's only when someone else has a different set of those that there's a conflict. And to understand that we have our goals, we have our values, we have our goals, we need to maintain those and protect them. That's absolutely necessary. But we also need to look at them and check to see if maybe things that we've stated as our values and goals are really just ways of keeping anybody different out. For instance, a very common example is that somebody who is applying for a job or who is applying for a promotion, there might be a little tick box on the sheet that the interviewer uses that says, how much Canadian experience do you have? Now, in some domains, Canadian experience is absolutely necessary, but it isn't always necessary, and it's often there even when it's not necessary. So for an employer, to an organization, needs to look at those artifacts that they're using to hire and promote people to see if there's any unintentional. I'm not suggesting any of this is intentional, but unintentional bias. And also, I think that the linchpin here is the manager. The manager is the secret to the whole thing. We find CEOs understand it; they get it at the entry level in organizations. They get it. It's the managers who need to learn to adapt, so they need awareness building. They need skills and knowledge to help them understand what it is that can be changed. And then they need to learn to practice mindful action. And that's, I forget what JP calls that in his, but it's basically being aware when something is occurring and learning, okay, this is a place where I could make that change, and then making that change until the point where it becomes a natural thing to do.
Now, I think there's a lot of talk about that in at least some of the larger centers across North America to be mindful, to help managers especially deal with this unintentional bias, as you've talked about. How are you finding the uptake on this inside organizations and a willingness to bring this in under whatever programs that they have so that you have a chance to have these kinds of trainings or conversations with managers?
Well, I think I'll talk about the challenges first. I think I'm really pleased with the uptake, but the issue seems to be at first level that most people still are focused on, okay, how can we make them change?
Yes.
Being the immigrants, right? How can we fix them? Let's see if we can understand their culture, meaning their country's culture. But what they don't realize is that cultures come from I define culture as a set of rules that a group defines that we live by. And so any group that you're a member of has a culture and has a set of rules and expectations, often that are unwritten and unspoken. I lost my train of thought there.
Yeah, so the uptake in talent management, inclusive talent management programs inside organizations.
Yeah. So there's the first problem is that there's still this focus on fixing the immigrant. The second problem is that they confuse what I'm trying to do with diversity management. They call it diversity management, and then what people hear is, oh, we need to make sure we hire X number of immigrants and X number of minorities into the organization. That's not what I'm about at all. What I'm about is making sure that the organization succeeds by tapping into the best qualified people available to them.
It's so interesting about the language, Linda. You've termed inclusive talent management to something that we're talking about here, and yet diversity management, which I think many organizations actually they call it that, and they have programs around that. And another term that I'd like you to comment on, because I know this term is also used in the career world, is cultural intelligence. And you know how important language is here. We were talking about that before with the term networking versus things like authentic communication. Mm-hmm. Can you talk about the language here and the diversity management, cultural intelligence, and how that's different?
This whole field is so difficult because every term seems to be laden with all kinds of stuff.
Yes.
Cultural intelligence, when I've heard people using the phrase cultural intelligence, then the reaction is also what you're telling me is I'm not intelligent. There's cultural competence, which means, okay, if I'm teaching you cultural competence, it means you're not competent. Cultural sensitivity, oh, you mean I'm not sensitive? I mean, it all comes back to, I think, a focus on, not on talent management, but on social justice. We've heard so much about this need to hire and promote immigrants and minorities because they are marginalized. And that's the wrong approach in my view.
Right.
We need to hire them and promote them because they are qualified, able, competent people.
Great. Thanks for that clarification. I think that actually does help, and it makes a lot of sense from the perspectives that we've been talking about.
Mm-hmm.
My guests today are Linda Manning and John Paul Hatala, researchers and professionals in the areas of social networking and social capital here on Career Buzz. I'm your host, Mark Franklin, on CIUT 89.5 FM in Toronto and CIUT.FM. Across the world, and we've got listeners from everywhere tuning in today, also welcoming listeners from the Association of Career Professionals International who are tapping in on today's show. We have a few more minutes, and I want to bring it down to the level of some practical things that are out there that individuals can do and organizations can do. JP, you've created a few fascinating resources to support some of the as you said earlier, the theory to practice perspective. For instance, I know you have something called the Game of Networking. Now, what is that, and why a game?
Well, game, you know, it came about from facilitating networking and it being not a cumbersome kind of process to talk about. So I thought, you know, it'd be more intriguing for participants if we had it into more of a game format. And that just walks them through the process and allows them to think strategically and basically learn without realizing that they're learning how to effectively maneuver through their own networks to accomplish a specific goal. So the game is based on the premise that you're assigned a goal and you have to accomplish it through the help of other players in the game, what resources they have to offer.
Nice. And now, how's the uptake on that game? Who's using it? What are they finding from it?
They're finding it, you know, it really breaks down. And again, it's used, you know, from high schools to colleges and universities to employment programs. I had it, it was used in MBA programs, again, getting them to think about, you know, networking from the conscious level and realizing that there's a process that you need to go through and it takes time. And so the upswing has been quite positive.
Nice. And there's also some online training I know that you've developed on job search and helping people use a kind of individualized approach using technology to support them to learn more about job search. How have you been finding that's been working?
And it's been working real well, and anything online is helpful because it can be done at its own pace. So it's self-directed tutorials, modules, if you will, and people can go in and go through the process at their own pace. And it really, you know, I think the gist in putting those together was to give them sort of a roadmap on how to become more effective at leveraging the resources within their networks. And, you know, at the crux of it all is again, and you said it as well, Mark, is being clear on what they want to accomplish. And it's amazing when goals are set and they're clear and they're being able to articulate it to their network, what could happen, what opportunities kind of present themselves.
Right on. And Linda, on your end, what are some of the more practical tools that you've implemented or used to bring some of the ideas we've talked about down to the level of just practical applications that people can use?
Well, I guess the number one thing is an online learning tool that we've developed called TalentNet. You can find it on the web at www.leadershipdiversity.ca. It's a free tool to use, and it's designed to teach managers how to interact effectively with immigrant employees or people from different cultures through employee engagement, performance appraisal, and early identification of high-potential employees.
Nice. Now, we just have a moment left, and what I'd like to do is bring it back to the personal. We talked a little bit about your own career stories and what led you to where you are now. So can I ask a brief question that might be a deeper but brief question about what you've each learned about making good career and life choices from your own personal experiences now? Just one or two things you can share with listeners about what you've learned about making good career and life choices. JP, can I start with you?
Yeah, I think it's simple for me. It's not just thinking about today, but how or what the decisions you make today affect you tomorrow. And I think that's really critical. So, you know, in my career, if I chose a job or took a job, how is it going to impact me down the road? And I think that served me well. You know, it did take me 13 years, but I eventually got there.
Right on. And JP, if people are interested in finding out more about Flowwork, how do they do that? Where can they go?
They can simply go to my website at flowwork.com, flowork.com.
Got it. And Linda, what about you? What have you learned from your personal experience about making good career and life choices?
Well, I kind of see it as an open road. You have a goal, maybe a long-term goal. You break it down into parts, and what you should be open to is changes in the, you know, the forks in the road might come along, and when the opportunity arises and it makes sense to take it.
Right on. And again, Linda, it's talentnet.com?
No, it's www.leadershipdiversity.ca.
Leadershipdiversity.ca.
Yeah, you find a link to the French and the English version of the tool.
Excellent. Linda Manning and JP Hatala, thank you so much for joining.